Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman, and I come to you weekly to discuss self-care and integrated health. Autism, a devastating diagnosis often given to parents of very young children. Until recently, it was considered a nervous disorder brought on by bad mothering. It was Bernard Rimlin who finally dispelled the myth of the refrigerator mother and focused attention on the very real biomedical basis of this disease. His early research proved that children improved substantially when highly allergic foods and additives were removed from their diet. Since then, numerous researchers and progressive physicians have begun to isolate numerous physiologic insults that are consistent in children with autism. Now, it won't surprise you to hear the list. It's the same environmental stressors that are being discussed in the development of numerous modern chronic illnesses. Still, autism is very specific and misunderstood. Today, we examine persistent myths about autistic people and review some groundbreaking natural treatments that are having promising results in the treatment of the underlying misfunctions that are at the root of autism. My guest is journalist Stephanie Marone. Her last name is Marhon, and her book is The Natural Medicine Guide to Autism. So welcome to you. I'm going to give you your due here. Stephanie Marone is the author of numerous books in the line, The Natural Medicine Guide. But these are books that are published by Hampton Roads Publishing. It's a six-book series called The Healthy Mind Guides. So some of the other books are Natural Medicine First Aid Remedies, Natural Medicine Guide to Autism is the one we're discussing today. There's also The Natural Guide to Depression, Natural Medicine Guide to Bipolar Disorder, and she's now completing has just completed Natural Guide to Addiction, Natural Medicine Guide to Anxiety, and the Natural Medicine Guide to Schizophrenia. They're due for release in the fall this year. These are all books that, except for the First Aid Guide, that explore so-called mental disorders as disorders of the mind, body, and spirit, and detail a range of natural medicine therapies that can reverse or ameliorate the symptoms. In addition to the above books, Ms. Marone has published over 30 articles in magazines and newspapers. And she has also served as senior editor of a natural medicine publishing house and health magazine. She lives in West County, Northern California. Being very secretive, you live in Sebastopol, yes, just to be honest. And she's sitting across from me here. Welcome to you.
I'm so delighted to be here. Thank you for having me on, Lena.
Yeah, I think you do need to be closer to your microphone.
Okay.
Slightly.
May I just give a quick correction? The spelling of my name, it's Marohn.
I'm pathological with spelling. You're right.
That's
I
okay.
Did. I spelled it. I was so careful to spell it,
I want people
it,
to be able to find it.
Yeah, so it's Marohn. Marone.
Thank you.
You know, for those people who are... Most people know what we're talking about when we talk about autism and what it's about, but the image that it conjures for most people is the Rain Man, as portrayed by Dustin Hoffman. That is one type of autism, but it isn't a common form of autism. So do you want to give people some overview of how much of a range there is in this disorder?
Yeah, we could start by saying that the Rain Man, he would have what we would call islets of ability. That was his ability to count cards. And if you remember the scene from the movie where somebody drops a box of matches on the floor and he counts them instantly, that is what is known as an islet of ability. Probably about 10% of people with autism have that. And it would also be... great music abilities, special music abilities. Other things in those areas are the ability to remember what happened on a certain date 3 years ago, that kind of thing. But that is not the most typical. The other people who have autism don't necessarily have that. So many of the symptoms that are also associated with autism that people think of are the lack of eye contact, which may or may not be the case. These are all these symptoms may or may not be the case. Not everybody has these, but the lack of eye contact, the hand flapping, the ritualistic kind of movements and behaviors, the perseveration that is kind of typical of a lot of two-year-olds anyway, but this would be ultra-perseveration of turning a light switch on and off and on and off, for example, just continuing to do that for as long as the parent will let them do it. Walking on tiptoe is another one. Echolalia, which is repeating someone exactly what someone says. And then, of course, what happens with a lot of children is that they may have speech to begin with and then lose it, so they just stop speaking, or they don't develop it at all.
There are two things that come to mind listening to you describe that. One is that there is an enormous misunderstanding on the part of most people about autism, and when you brought up the eye contact issue, you talk about in the book the fact that these children are not, they don't lack affection. It isn't that they can't connect with other people. It's that their way of connecting is very unique. And part of the problem, and this is something that I knew about autism, I have interviewed Bernard Rimland twice, and of course he has an autistic son who is really pretty high functioning at this point, is that they are actually sort of overwhelmed all the time. It isn't that they're withdrawn. It's that they are easily overwhelmed, and these rituals that they do are comforting. They sort of organize things in a way that's manageable for them. Do you want to talk a little about that?
Yes, I would love to, because that's something of great interest to me, and that is it ties into what all of us who are involved with natural medicine know, is that the body has its wisdom. And that these are not nonsensical behaviors. There's a reason for all of them. I'll talk for a minute about the head banging. That's also typical,
yes,
where they bang their heads against the wall or against the floor. There's one of the doctors that I interviewed that has this idea that this is a way to relieve the actual pressure in the brain, because what she has discovered and other doctors have discovered is that one of the causes of autism can actually be brain, like a distortion of the skull that actually causes the brain to feel, you could say, irritated. So there's an attempt to relieve that pressure feeling. And that is one thing. The eye contact, what you could say about autism is that it's the nervous system gone haywire. And in many cases, this means that the overstimulation is incredible. People who have written about autism as adults, people who are autistic and have been able to communicate what that experience is like, when they describe it, some of them talk about how they'll just see these lights in the air all the time, and they hear sounds in this very powerful way. There's one film about autism where the child, the father relates the story that the child, they were all sitting around family and friends having a party, and they had the stereo on, people were talking, there was the noise of the glasses clinking, and this child says, "Quiet, I want to hear the airplane." And nobody could hear this at all. They shut off the stereo, they all got quiet, and they heard an airplane after a moment way, way in the distance. So with that kind of stimulation coming in, they have got to shut down some of it somewhere. And so looking away from people may be one way to do that.
One of the things that strikes me when I read or interview somebody about autism, especially because the root causes are so much the same as other chronic illnesses that are kind of modern in nature, and autism is at an epidemic proportion right now, is the similarities in certain ways of the symptoms, just not as, they're not as overwhelming. But you'll see in people with autoimmune diseases and people with multiple chemical sensitivities, for instance, an acuity of hearing, so that sound is very overwhelming. Light is overwhelming to people who are either very allergic or suffering from a sort of a low-grade poisoning reaction, as people with multiple chemical sensitivities are doing, since they're not clearing things properly. So these are youngsters, these are children who have no physiologic or psychologic filters in a certain way. And that's true of adults with chronic illnesses as well. It's just that they may be able to function slightly better, but they're echoes. So there are lessons about studying autism, I think, for modern illness.
I agree with you. I think that's an excellent point. And one of the things is that I think we could say that our nervous systems and our immune systems are under assault by all of the toxins in our environment. And as an adult, many of us can handle it for a certain amount of time, and then it may all break down into something like multiple chemical sensitivities. For a child whose nervous and immune systems are developing, this is it's not surprising that toxins can play a role in wreaking havoc of all kinds. And while this connection has not been clearly made in research, I think it's rather logical to say that this plays a role. Especially some of the studies have shown that children with autism have a higher percentage of toxins in their body, and there is a heavy metal presence, and perhaps they have a genetic susceptibility that makes them less able to cope with the amount that there is around us.
So why don't we go over a few of the sorts of main, because one of the things that's really evident when you read your book, The Natural Medicine Guide to Autism, is that all of the practitioners that you interviewed all talk about the same areas of importance to test and check. So there's a list. I have most of them written down here, but you might want to go over them. And I think that, again, it'll read like any natural, any complementary or integrative doctor would look at these areas.
With one proviso, and that is somebody like a cranial osteopath is really focusing on the distortions that can happen from birth. And he has, this in particular, this one doctor that I talked to, he has found that Pitocin-induced labor, that's the drug that speeds up labor, is one of the factors, an epidural block. These are two factors that can really contribute to brain distortions, because it's basically using the baby's head as a battering ram to get the birth to happen. So, and cranial osteopathic adjustments after birth can correct the distortions that are compressing the brain. But a doctor like that, even a doctor like that who has this area of expertise, would still say if the child has been autistic for a while, there's certain things you have to look at, and would probably send them to some other doctors to deal with nutritional deficiencies that have developed as a result of the digestive dysfunction. And you can't say with all of these, I'll give you the list in a moment, but you can't say with all of these, it's the chicken or the egg dilemma. Which one came first? It's very difficult to unravel, but here's the list of things that are often present and need to be addressed. And that is digestive dysfunction. Candida overgrowth can often be a factor in that. Malabsorption, so that then results in nutritional deficiencies. There are a number of nutritional deficiencies that tend to go with autism. B6, zinc, and magnesium and omega omega-3s, essential fatty acids, are ones that tend to go with it. There's the heavy metal toxins. There's the chemical toxins. So doing a detox is a great idea. What am I missing on the list?
There's also a highly allergic and even almost autoimmune quality to these kids, too.
And I think it's important for people to know, and probably many of the listeners do know this, being KPFA listeners, that allergies, there is something now that people are calling brain allergies. And what this means is that it's not the conventional symptoms associated with allergies, which a lot of people think of: wheezing, sneezing, red eyes, runny eyes. These are cerebral allergies or brain allergies. What that means is that the symptoms of your allergies, whatever kind of allergies you have, are resulting in brain or mental symptoms. So this has been found to be an issue for many autistic children.
You know, one thing that I thought of, too, while I was reading about all of this, and I didn't have a chance to stop and look in the Merck manual for the actual description, but there is, we had acknowledged that we both know Richard Cunyon, K-U-N-I-N, who I've interviewed on the show many times, and the thing that he's discovered recently that is turning out to be present in almost his, like 90% of his patient load, is a DNA malfunction or actual mutation called MTHFR, which is a faulty methylation process in the brain. and can lead to, in its worst case scenario, can lead to conditions like obsessive compulsive and Tourette's. Now, obsessive compulsive disorder and Tourette's are similar in some ways to autism. There are similarities, and there may be root causes that are similar, but MTHFR has a couple of mutations, and people can have very extreme version, but these definitely run in families. Mm-hmm. We're beginning to get to this point where we're discovering that people will have a hypersensitivity or hypervulnerability, aside from the birth trauma, which certainly is not an inconsequential thing, but that people, through their genetic line, will sometimes have a lower resistance to exposure to certain things. And then, of course, when they get exposed, like if the mother, as you pointed out, it's horrifying to realize this, if the mother has a lot of amalgam fillings, the baby may be getting exposed to mercury, mercury being an enormously controversial issue now, because there are actually people who are saying, it's not that big a deal.
That's amazing to me.
Well, there are, though.
I know there are, and if you look at the research, I don't see how you can say that. You bring up several really good points in there. One is that people have tended, in the past this was considered the case after the refrigerator mother theory, that autism was genetic, you couldn't escape it. And then now with the biochemical emphasis of mental illness, they're still saying that these things are genetic or that they run in families. But one of the doctors that I interviewed, he put it beautifully. This was Dr. William Walsh, who I'll say in a minute about his landmark discovery regarding autism. But he says genetics is not, it doesn't mean that it's inevitable. It just is chemistry. So you learn to work with the chemistry, and you can correct what are viewed as genetic problems. But a big trend that's happening today in both natural medicine and conventional is that there's more of a recognition of, you may have a genetic susceptibility or vulnerability, as you say, and if you can avoid the environmental triggers, you may never develop the disorder. So the important thing is to educate yourself about the environmental triggers. Now, with children who are susceptible, anything that is an onslaught on their immune or nervous system is to be avoided. That would include heavy metals. So things that people don't know, like, say, jacuzzis or hot tubs that have copper sulfate to keep the algae down, you don't want to give them any extra exposure to copper, because this brings us to Dr. Walsh's discovery, which is that it seems that one of the genetic components might be a metal metabolism problem. And this is a malfunction in what is known as the metallothionine system. Now, metallothionine can cover a lot of, this has many functions in the body, and you can explain all of the cluster of things that are connected with autism by a malfunction in this system. The immune dysregulation, the nervous system dysregulation, the gastrointestinal dysregulation. Metallothionine is involved in all of those systems. So this, I think, is landmark research. And
it's a protein, and what we're concerned with are peptides, or are we talking about the methylation of the protein?
It's not the peptides. It is, from my understanding, and I'm not a biochemist, which Dr. Walsh is, the metallothionine is a protein that is involved in all of these different functions, and that one of its main functions is metabolizing metal in the body. So this means heavy metal, but this also means the minerals. This explains why many autistic children have high levels of copper in relation to zinc. And you always have to consider those levels in relationship to each other. This is very high copper in relation to low zinc. And one of the reasons why that is happening is the body can't deal with the copper because there's a metallothionine dysfunction.
And what's interesting is that it looks as though that's also shows up in these MTHFR is low zinc and an elevated copper, although the copper may not be through the roof. But you see, and you also... low zinc is also a flag for thyroid disease. So it's, what I kept feeling reading this is that this research is going to all tie in at some point with other conditions.
Well, Dr. Walsh, one of the things they specialize in, by the way, for listeners who know this, he's the what I call the heir apparent to Carl Pfeiffer, who was such a pioneer in the research into mental disorders, beginning with schizophrenia. They, at their treatment center in Warrenville, Illinois, they treat a whole range of mental and emotional disorders. And the beautiful thing about the work they're doing is that they keep very specific databases. So, for example, they have a database of 503 autistic children, and they're using strict criteria for saying that these are autistic children. It's not just accepting whatever diagnosis people come in with. They came up with a cluster that they said, okay, if they meet these criteria, then we can call them autistic. And so they have 503 autistic children. They have all the biochemistry from these kids. And all but four of them showed evidence of this metallothionine problem.
Oh, boy. That's really impressive.
Yeah.
You're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman, and I'm live in studio with Stephanie Marone, and I'm going to read the spelling of her last name so I don't make another mistake. It's M-A-R-O-H-N, Marone. Her book, The Natural Medicine Guide to Autism, is published through Hampton Roads. Roads. Thank you. Is available in paperback. It's called The Healthy Mind Guides. And we're discussing autism. Carl Pfeiffer, his genius, I think, was his interest in, well, what he's famous for is his interest in an understanding of amino acids and their pharmacologic effect when they're used, you know, separated from a meal. And many people have then gone on to do work with amino acids in the treatment of mental disorders. I've interviewed Eva Edelman, who's done a lot of chronicling of the research. Joan Matthews Larson uses that approach, and she mentored Julie Ross, who has a clinic in Mill Valley, who works with eating disorders and other addictions. So there's been this thing of using amino acid therapy for treating addiction and mental disorders. But this goes way beyond, of course. Am I remembering correctly that Walsh also has discovered that some of the what they call biotypes, like the pyroloric and high histamine types, he's also working with those too, right?
Yes, that is probably the central piece of his work. So, and it was Carl Pfeiffer who was looking at. We won't probably go into the details here of the high histamine and methylation issues that happen with mental disorders, but this is less of a factor here.
I thought it was a factor.
It is, but it is kind of like a dual factor. The basic problem is the metal metabolism problem, and then on top of that, they can sometimes have some of these other imbalances, which would be the pyroloric and the methylation issues. I just want to say that one of the things in terms of amino acids is that amino acids are part of the program to get the metallothionine working again. So that's the way you have to upbuild that system is this is vitamin B6, zinc, right along with Dr. Rimland's program and all the research that he did. And then amino acids and manganese is another one of the supplements that kind of jumpstart the metallothionine and vitamin C.
There's a big one.
Yeah, yeah.
It's interesting. There was a surprise as an overview, many of the physicians that you interviewed and practitioners that you interviewed that are doing nutrient therapy also, because there's the woman in the beginning of the book.
Dr. Miley Pools, yeah.
Yeah, who is in Santa Cruz, so she's...
She's based in Santa Cruz, but now in Hawaii as well. So, you know.
Farther away.
Tough life.
Yeah, that is disturbing. I hope she's okay. is that that antioxidant therapy should not be used too aggressively with autistic patients because of... you don't want to get the detox pathways moving too fast.
Yes, and Dr. Walsh says that as well. Mm-hmm. You have to be very careful because if you wake up the metallothionine too rapidly, it'll start dealing with all the heavy metals in the body, and that's high stress on the system to try to get those out so quickly.
So I want to go on and talk more about some of the environmental issues and other pollutants and and whatnot and the other treatment. But it might be interesting for a moment to just compare what we're talking about to what standard treatments for autism are like. Pretty disturbing, I think.
Yeah, I would say quite disturbing. In my view, parents out there can draw their own conclusions when you can look at the... If you have a chance to look at the results, I think you'll be shocked and appalled. I just want to mention that there was a review of this book that was published in the Library Journal. I know very little about the Library Journal. It was a scathing review. It's the only bad review I got. And as far as I can tell, there was no credentials listed for this person, so as far as I can tell, they're not a doctor. And they seem to know very little about autism. One of the things they said was, well, she doesn't even mention behavior modification. And the reason why I don't mention behavior modification, that is probably the mainstay of conventional approach to autism. It's M&M therapy. I'll just be rash and say that. It's M&M therapy. So what you're doing is training the child to behave well.
What do you mean by M&M?
They give M&Ms as rewards often.
Oh, you mean like treats for dogs when
exactly.
They do the right trick?
Exactly.
So you get these kids to do the right trick and you give them
M&Ms. M&Ms.
Which is a good thing for them to have with the colorings and the sugar and the chocolate and all the things
that
they're not supposed to have.
And if they have a candida overgrowth, you know, sugar is so fabulous for that.
Yeah.
So
boy.
I know that I can speak like this because I'm on KPFA. There are many parents that would probably get upset and say, well, my child's really been helped by behavior modification. That's great. I'm really glad. And my view of it is that it is doing nothing for the child. It is not addressing any of the underlying problems. All it is doing is making them easier to live with. And
well, the long-term repercussions of something like that is horrifying since... autistic children can sometimes grow into functional, highly functioning adults and have full lives, independent lives. But if all they've done is sort of tighten their butt cheeks and roll over and play dad for mommy and daddy, when mommy and daddy aren't there to care for them, they're pretty much dependent.
Yes, and I would go even further and say that there... many of the cases related to me by the doctors that I cover in this book, they have reversed autism. So it is not just about being...
The
natural medicine
right.
approach.
Yeah.
That if it's possible to help people, get rid of these symptoms and move on in life, how wonderful. And I just think that not to look at what is happening on with the underlying imbalances in a person... it's bordering on malpractice.
Oh, I'd say so.
Yeah. And there, you know, the good news about the natural medicine approach is that you don't have to purely identify the causes. You just look at what is going on in this child on all the levels. So urine testing and hair analysis can determine what's happening nutritionally and whether there are heavy metals in the body.
Gut profiles?
Yes, gut profiles. The blood testing to determine levels of various substances in the body. I mean, all of these things are so basic, and they're not being done in a lot of cases. So in answer to your question, another one of the conventional approaches is antifungal therapy because it has been recognized that they have a fungal overgrowth, meaning candida in most cases. So this means more heavy drugs these are prescription drugs, more heavy drugs that that put another burden on the immune system. And they have found that they may work in the short term to reduce symptoms because they keep the candida under control, but once the person goes off the antifungals, it all comes back because the same imbalances are there. So to not address these is really pretty criminal.
We need to take a brief break, a brief musical break. When we return, we'll continue this live interview with Stephanie Marohn, M-A-R-O-H-N, her book, The Natural Medicine Guide to Autism. I'm Lena Berman. This is your own Health and Fitness. Please stay with us. Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman in the studio with Stephanie Marohn, M-A-R-O-H-N, her book, The Natural Medicine Guide to Autism. It's one of the Healthy Mind Guides through Hampton Roads.
Yeah.
Okay. It only takes me about six tries to memorize something. This is primarily a situation where if people want to get a hold of the book, they go to the bookstore and ask for the book? Is there a website?
I have a website that's coming up. I mean, it's already registered. I'm building it at the moment.
Please be patient. Yeah,
StephanieMarohn.com when it goes up. But you can get the book anywhere.
S-T-E-P-H-A-N-I-E, Stephanie, S-T-E-P-H. People are going to ask me how to spell Stephanie, believe me, P-H-A-N-I-E-M-A-R-O-H-N, StephanieMarohn.com, and she is under construction, as are we all, actually, I think, in the best sense of the word. If people need to get a copy of today's show or any other in the series, Your Own Health and Fitness, you can call my information number 24 hours a day at 707-874-2772, or you can go to the website yourownhealthandfitness.com. The other thing about Candida, you know, it's interesting. When I was in the early 80s, I was treated by several environmental ecologists during that time when that was all very big. And there was I was doing that neutralization, provocation, neutralization type of allergy treatments where they were trying to find a neutralizing dose of offending substances. And there was a kid that used to come in, and he was highly sensitive to molds. He was very infested with high candida, and he would act slightly normal until they provoked him with a mold, and then he would go out of his mind until they found a neutralization dose. So he was, it was day and night, too. It was quite profound. I mean, if you ever had any doubt about the impact of very small amounts of substances that are irritants to vulnerable people in the environment, this was one of them. But there is a integral relationship between candida and mercury and other heavy metals. I understood that one of the reasons it wasn't a good idea to obliterate, well, first of all, candida is a normal fungus in the body. It's when it's when its antagonists are not present, and it overgrows, and people get all these, you know, itchy things in their genital areas, and lots of athlete's foot and itchy ears, and bloating in the gut and stuff. That it's gone out of its mind, partially because somebody's been feeding it a lot of sugar, which it likes. But my understanding also was that you don't want to try to completely eliminate it because it does have a tendency to eat up a bunch of metal in the body. And what I was reading in your book is that it's actually worse news than that. It isn't that the candida is clearing the body of metals. It's that the candida is partially overgrown because of the presence of the metals, and it will not really go away until the metal problem is under control.
Mm-hmm. This may not be true for everyone, but it's certainly true in some cases. And this is where I got that piece of information was from this doctor who's absolutely brilliant. He's a Swiss doctor, Dr. Thomas Rau, R-A-U. And he has discovered that, and I haven't seen this anywhere else actually, that that candida, one of the reasons why it's in our body is to deal with mercury and other heavy metals. And it's especially good with mercury. So he has said, and he has discovered this with his patients, that until they get the mercury out, which would be through chelation, either oral or intravenous, and a proviso here that most of the doctors say it's not a good idea to do intravenous chelation with little children.
Yeah, well, sometimes not with adults. It's sometimes because people who are in an inhibited state physically from an onslaught of a variety of things, including metals, are not going to have good detox pathways, and they also don't eliminate well.
Yes.
So they get constipated, they don't sweat, so stuff is bouncing around inside of them when they start releasing it.
Right. Now, what Dr. Walsh has found is that if you balance out the metallothionine system, you often don't need to do a detox because it starts taking care of it itself. And there is another doctor in the book, Dr. Miley Pools, that has an oral chelation formula that she has used with the children that she treats, and it works very well. Dr. Walsh would probably say that you're not going to be able to solve the problem until you deal with the metallothionine. But Dr. Pools is getting great results, and the kids may have to stay on the supplements for a while. but she's getting great results.
Yeah, the chelating substances that she's using are not that mysterious. Some of them are pretty easy to get your hands on. Chlorella, garlic,
cilantro
is a big one in a tincture form. Some people can tolerate some of the other things that were in there, and some people can't. You know, like bombarding them with methionine and cysteine for some people isn't going to work because their sulfation pathways don't work. But
right.
So I'm talking here about the fact that some of these, as I said, some of these problems that are underlying in autism are also present in other ill people.
It would be really great. Could I just insert here? It would be really great if we talked for a moment about vaccines and homeopathy.
Yeah, I was kind of I wasn't going.
You working down there?
I was working down to the vaccine controversy. So
okay,
I'm
go
just going to let no, you go.
Okay, I wanted to say the reason why I want to bring this up is because homeopathy, what it can do in relation to vaccines is really marvelous, because there is a lot of talk now, controversy over are vaccines causing autism. I think the statistics show pretty clearly that if not the vaccines, at least the way they're being administered is contributing to the rise in autism. Autism has risen incredibly over the last 20 years, and coincidentally, at the same time, the number of vaccines that children receive in their first 2 years of life has also risen phenomenally from 8 in what was the date on that? They're now receiving 22. In 2001, they were receiving 22, and they were getting 8 20 years ago. So this cannot be ignored. And many of the vaccines that children get have a preservative in it that's a compound of mercury, thimerosal, it's called. And there's a lot of controversy over this right now. But in my view, why do we need to wait for proof? If there is any doubt that it's not okay to put this into little children's bodies, why would we be doing it? So there's now the CDC has said, okay, it's not a good idea for the vaccines to be preserved with mercury. They're agreeing with that. But the last I heard, they were allowing the vaccine manufacturers to use up their stores. I don't know if that's been changed, but that's the last I heard.
Well, you also have in your book, it goes from page 49 to page 51, a list of other ingredients in vaccines. And, you know, I wouldn't be in the same room with all of these things combined, you know? I mean, we've got aluminum, ammonium sulfate, an antifungal drug, antibiotics, a chemical that's recognized as carcinogenic, whose name I can't pronounce, formaldehyde, one of my favorite chemicals, carcinogen, hydrolyzed gelatin. We don't want to think about that. That's kind of a disgusting thing. Monosodium glutamate, a lot of people react very nicely to that, feel good after that. Phenol, ethanol, antifreeze, it's an antifreeze. Polysorbate, sorbitol, sucrose, the mercury that we talked about, a tributyl phosphate, which is a neurotoxin, morphomeldehyde. Here's the separate independent vaccines and what they have in them. Very frightening ingredients. The other thing is that children are given these, as you say, all at once. And they do this with animals, too, and they combine them.
Mm-hmm.
They combine these things, these vaccinations, too.
Yeah, and then I just want to say, because I know that vaccines are a big issue for parents to deal with.
Well, it's frightening. And they're afraid their kids are going to get sick.
And I just want to say that there are ways to do it to cut down on the danger. One is, you know, the recommendations that from various people regarding if you want to go ahead and give your children vaccinations, don't get the multiple ones. Have them given separately. Give them a month apart at least. And there are certain ones that you don't need to give until after they're older. So if you can wait until after they're 2 years old, please wait. Then if you really feel that you need to go ahead, there are homeopathic remedies that can clear the adverse reactions from the body, which is a marvelous thing to have available. So, for example, homeopaths have had good success with children who are autistic who had, say, the MMR vaccine, measles, mumps, rubella. They get multiple doses of that over the installments, you could say. Children, and this seems to be one of the ones that's really implicated in autism. And that's not to say necessarily causing it, but it's one of the environmental triggers. It's one of the onslaughts. So it seems to be. There's a preparation of a homeopathic. There's a homeopathic preparation. It's not a remedy. It's called a nosode. N-O-S-O-D-E. It's a special preparation of the disease material. So this would be measles, mumps, rubella. When they give this as a nosode to some children who, for whom vaccination has been an issue, they're reversing symptoms of autism with it. It's amazing. And then there are homeopathic remedies that you can use to help your child through these childhood illnesses. Either there are homeopathic remedies that can be given as a preventive, and then there are ones that can be used when the child is ill. And there's a lot of, many holistic doctors believe that these childhood illnesses are there for a reason. It's to temper the immune system. It's kind of like tempering steel. You put it through fire. And this doesn't mean to allow your child to have 105-degree temperature. It means help them through these illnesses. It strengthens their immune system, because one of the things that they're finding is people who have been vaccinated have chronic illnesses later that people who have not been vaccinated tend to not develop.
All the good literature I've seen that's anti-vaccination points out this issue, and my impression is that the nosodes can also be used as an alternative to a vaccine.
That would be the preventive measure, yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But that it's sometimes better for kids to have not life-threatening versions of these. But, you know, it's the people who are... If I'm reading minds over the air right now, I'm thinking that people are saying, well, you know, that's nice, but you know, you don't want to be in that situation where it's a life-threatening situation, you haven't vaccinated, and now it's too late. But I think by way of encouragement to people is to note that there are studies that have looked at unvaccinated children and their immune systems, and there have been comparisons done, and it looks favorable. Also, children who are generally healthy and have not had traumas either prenatally, before birth, because the mother's been under a traumatic situation or the mother's overloaded with pollutants. I mean, we're talking also here, unfortunately, about people who are... underprivileged in this country, who are exposed to tremendous pollutants in their living situations and don't have access to good health care, are often the worst victims of this type of situation, where the mothers are either exposed to a lot of toxins and are nursing them. I mean, it goes on and on and on. So there are a lot of victims in this situation with toxic exposure and illnesses as a cause. But most children, if they're raised in a reasonably healthy environment and there isn't a family history of really frightening stuff, the kids will get sick and they'll get better and they'll have really strong immune systems, especially if they've been nursed mm-hmm. for a good long time. Even if you're chancing a little bit of pollution through the breast milk, the colostrum and all these other things really help. The other thing that I thought of is that the controversy is taking, you know, the problem with studies, the problem with conventional studies is that you have to look at the way the question was asked, because it can be asked in a way to get any outcome they want. And so when they did things like look at the DTP vaccine or the MMR, and they did these very specialized studies, and they said, see, there is no evidence that these kids got sick. They're not talking about combining them and multiple vaccinations and various things like that. But the thing that's the most damning is that in the incidents where we see kids getting autistic, which incidentally happens very early in life, it's a child, maybe they're okay in the first 2 years of their lives and then bang, they get really ill, is that kids often get sick right after they've been given vaccinations.
Yes, this one homeopath that I know well and have talked to often, she's just told me horrifying stories of of the kinds of things she's seen after vaccinations, all the way to paralysis. I mean, it's really, really horrible. And they keep giving the shots when the child is nearing paralysis and keep giving the shots. I mean, it's just unbelievable. I want to add something about the vaccination issue that, you know, the issue you raised about underprivileged children. Homeopaths are not available to everyone.
They're expensive.
Yeah, and if you have conventional medical coverage, whether it's subsidized or whatever, you're probably not going to have access to this. So I just wanted to say some things that are really important for everyone, that everyone can do, and that is that tell your doctor you do not want 3-in-1 shots. You want them given separately, and you want them given a month apart. And when you're going into the hospital or wherever you're going to have your child make it very clear you do not want them to give your new infant the hepatitis B shot at birth. That has been universal policy. And, you know, many people in the midst of childbirth, they sign forms, and they may sign a waiver saying, yes, go ahead and do this, and not be aware of what they're signing. So state it very clearly. You do not want your infant to have this shot. There is no reason on earth to give this shot unless you have hepatitis B yourself. This is about 0.2% of the women who give birth in hospitals.
Well, you could be a carrier for it, too, which is difficult.
Right. And then the only, you know, the time when people are going to be exposed to this is going to be at least, well, it's younger and younger these days, but 11 at the very least. So 11 years old. So why are they giving it at birth? Because the way it's transmitted.
Well, because of the mother, because of the mother's potential carry, being a carrier for it.
But they did a test, and it's 0.2%. That's not just people who are active.
Well, you know, the other thing about the issue of homeopathy being homeopaths being pricey for someone who has a low income is that there are many, many books on homeopathy that do teach you how to do home treatment. And homeopathy is so safe that you can self-treat if you look up remedies and various things.
With the exception of the nosodes. That's not something that
You can't do by yourself.
No.
But you can certainly take Thuya or one of the other remedies that are used for vaccinosis after a vaccine and various things like that. And her name is Laura Joseph. I did a show with a homeopath, and her book, I don't remember the name of it, but it will be on my website on the tape list. Laura Joseph's book on homeopathy, Dana Ullman. The Ullman family seems to have people all over the world who are all connected up, who are all homeopaths and have done many writing and studying. So stuff is available, and homeopathic remedies are still fairly inexpensive.
And there are some homeopaths who will do pro bono, and so that's good, too.
You're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness again. This is Lena Berman. I'm in the studio with Stephanie Marone, M-A-R-O-H-N, and we're discussing the Natural Medicine Guide to Autism, and we've been talking about the use of homeopathy with to prevent and help people with autism. How precisely does homeopathy work for autism? It's rather shocking to think that the other physicians are doing tests to check function of the immune system, the gut, the presence of metals and funguses, and then they're addressing nutrient deficiencies and allergies. And then a homeopath can step in without having done any of this, give the child a remedy, and have some kind of effect happen.
It's less about the constitutional remedy work that would be the approach with other conditions. You know, people might go to a homeopath when they have allergies, for example, and the homeopath would give them the specific constitutional remedy that's appropriate for them. And this is not so much what's happening with autism. In some cases, it is. There's one, Judith Reichenberg Ullman, for example, has used that to effect. But in my view, where the great strength of homeopathy lies in terms of autism is with the clearing of the adverse reactions of the vaccines, and that would be the nosodes, and also as an alternative to vaccines and as a treatment for the illnesses. But the constitutional work has produced effect too, and I think this brings up one of the points with natural medicine is that it's frequently not one therapy.
Yeah.
You know, you put together a program, and so part of your program might be constitutional treatment of homeopathy, because Dr. Ullman certainly has gotten good results with that. And then it might be addressing nutritional factors, and it might be dealing with the metal metabolism problem. So doing the whole cluster to get the whole person back together.
And you do want to start with the least invasive things first. I had a mother and grandmother come in with a little girl who had been acting normal for a long time, and then suddenly she was about five, all of a sudden started to act very oddly, started to exhibit symptoms of obsessive compulsive, was washing her hands, was afraid to eat certain things, wasn't focusing her eyes, wasn't looking at people, and they brought her in and she was very pale. She looked really terrible. And I explained that I'm not a physician. I can't, you know, but that I would, you know, talk to them and talk to the child and I talk to the mother. And then what I suggested was that it and this is the sort of thing that you want to think of first, is that she may have been exposed to something at school and it was just one too many things, and her system has just gone into this override. They were having trouble feeding her, so I had the child and the mother leave the room, and I talked to the grandmother, and I suggested a kind of pre-agricultural diet that was very low in allergens, and we talked about some tricks to get her to eat differently, to see if we could start with that and then start with a few vitamins. And just see what happened, see if removing, you know, and if protecting, you know, checking the environment to make sure the school environment was okay. And she did get some improvement. That wasn't going to be the stopping place, I don't think. I think they went on and did more, but she began to come around. So it's, you do want to start with the least invasive things first.
I also think that's a great place to start, because if you allow the nutritional and digestive problems to go on, those deficiencies are going to cause other problems and run down the system even more. So that's a great place to start.
Well, you start wherever you can put a stick in the wheel. Mm-hmm. And then, as you say, you may want to use a complement of many different practitioners mm-hmm. to go on.
You know, it occurs to me when you say she may have gotten something at school, the pesticides they yes. use there and the what they use to clean the carpets,
yes.
it's all so toxic.
And the schools are often moldy. The old buildings mm-hmm. are extremely
yeah.
moldy.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, another thing people don't realize is that golf courses are horribly toxic because of the herbicides that they use constantly on the... So, I mean, children that live near golf courses are often at risk, too.
Yeah.
One thing I wanted to go back to is we were talking about the copper to zinc ratio and the difficulty with the high copper in the kids, and you were talking about eliminating... I mean, because, you know, we were talking about access to copper, and another thing that copper is used for is a preservative to protect wood, so it's often... But the other thing is that people use copper pipes, and I'm wondering whether any of the doctors that you interviewed were concerned about copper pipes.
Well, the recommendation throughout natural medicine for everybody, for everything, is bottled water. So
filtering water doesn't get the copper out?
If you have the right kind of filter in your house, yes.
And do you have a hint on what that might be?
There's some controversy. Some say the reverse osmosis, and some say, no, that takes out some of the vital things.
Well, vital things you can take in a vitamin.
Right. So reverse osmosis, that process.
Carbon block doesn't remove copper, huh?
I don't think so, no.
Okay, that's interesting.
Yeah.
All right, let's, if we might, toward the end here, talk a little bit about the cranial osteopathy versus cranial sacral, both of which have been found useful.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
The cranial osteopathy, this was not a field that I was very acquainted with when I first started researching these books, and I've learned a lot about it. I, of course, was acquainted with the craniosacral, and I assumed those were, I just kind of lumped them together. They're not the same thing. The craniosacral work comes from John Upledger. And many people know that because there are, especially here in California, there are a lot of craniosacral therapists. They're both working with similar things in that the John Upledger work, the craniosacral, is working with a craniosacral system, cranial as in cranium head and sacral as in tailbone, sacrum. And one of the things that many people might not know is that that is really a breathing mechanism. There's the fluid, the cerebrospinal fluid that bathes the brain and the spine. And it has a pulse and a rhythm. It's like breathing in and out, up and down. And that rhythm gets disturbed by compression in the brain. And so the craniosacral method is dealing a lot with the rhythm of all of that and the implications throughout the body, because it affects all body systems. And they both work with restoring that rhythm. But the way that the cranial osteopathy, what cranial osteopathy focuses on is the bones of the head. And that these plates, people think of it as a very solid thing, but even in adults, it's rather movable. These are shifting plates. And, I mean, they're not shifting when you're just walking around. But as I said, the cerebrospinal fluid has a respirative kind of movement in and out. And so the skull is somewhat fluid. It's responding to that in and out. And so with what happens in birth, especially with, as I said, the Pitocin-induced labor and the epidural block, with the child's head being used as a battering ram.
Or, God forbid, forceps.
Or forceps, yes. That used to be much more of a problem, but they're still used, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
And so the head, what happens is it's like the petals of a flower where it closes in and then opens up as it comes through the canal. That's what's supposed to happen. But with that kind of labor, it comes through in a closed position and it doesn't open up. And so the cranial osteopathic work at birth, after birth, that's one of the things that parents can attend to is say, okay, does my infant, was this a difficult labor? Might it be good to get a cranial osteopathic adjustment right at birth? That can go a long way toward preventing autism.
Suddenly, I can't breathe.
You can't breathe. The pedals of your head.
No, they're not. This is the headphones. They're squishing.
They're stopping that cerebral spinal fluid flow, huh?
Well, I've always been interested in this whole cranial work.
Yes,
I've just had somebody do a little bit of it on me, and it just made my mouth water. It was so delicious. So I think it can correct a lot of hip and back problems and all kinds of stuff. But so how would you consider them different?
What I would say about the other one is
craniosacral
work.
There's
a component of craniosacral work that's dealing with stored emotions in the body, what they call energy cysts. This is the SER, somato-emotional release. And Upledger, this was an offshoot of the original craniosacral work that he developed. This is dealing with the emotional storage in the body of trauma. Now, and she discovered when they're working on people on the table that through the body you can take people back to what happened to them. And they may or may not realize it cognitively, but often they will take the position on the table. Their body will just go ahead and assume the position of moments in their life when there was trauma. So little kids will go into the fetal position if something was happening when they were in utero. And then the positions that they take, sometimes in one case the mother was sitting there and she said, oh, I recognize that. That is when it was a certain moment during birth when I guess they were using forceps or something else, and she recognized that this is what was going on. And these people think of, it's common now, much more common now, to think of the psychological trauma that adults carry from, say, when they're in the first 5 years of life. But it's not really acknowledged that what about infants and what about in utero, what about during birth? I mean, think about it. Birth can be a very traumatic process.
No, I mean, most of the body-based therapies, like Reiki and therapy, has had people go back to birth, have traumatic birth experiences or experienced.
So this is a technique for removing
are we talking about the cranial osteopathy, or are we talking about the craniosacral?
No, that's the craniosacral, because they're addressing the emotional component, and I would say that's a big difference between them. The cranial osteopathy is really dealing with the structure of the body.
Okay.
Yeah.
So they both work for preventing autism and maybe even doing some treatment work?
I don't think we have enough information to say it can prevent, but it's to deal with undoing the compression in the head right after birth is a good idea. Matter what.
Yeah, no matter what. Okay. We're kind of out of time. That's why he's pointing his fingers at us. It wasn't a peace sign. I think it was a two-minute sign. You've been a wonderful guest, and I guess what we can say for parents is that if they are finding that their child is beginning to exhibit disturbing symptoms and they're concerned, the first thing they might want to do is maybe do some reading. And certainly this book would be a good place to start. The Natural Medicine Guide to Autism. My guest has been Stephanie Marohn, M-A-R-O-H-N. These are available through Hampton Roads Publishing. You can ask your bookstore to order them. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me. It's been great.
It was great, yeah. I want to thank all of you for listening, and I'm Lena Berman. If you need more information or if you want a cassette copy of this show or any other in the series, Your Own Health and Fitness, you can call my information number 24 hours a day at 707-874-2772, 874-2772 in the 707. For a list of other available shows, go to the website, yourownhealthandfitness.com, yourownhealthandfitness.com. Next week, by request, I'll be doing a show by myself to talk about how to prevent and treat hypertension and heart disease without drugs. The engineer for Your Own Health and Fitness on the Sebastopol side is George Curtis at the Powerhouse Brewery. Thank you to Johnny Otis and the Powerhouse, and at KPFA, Sally Phillips. I'm Lena Berman. Your Own Health and Fitness is produced by Free Speech Radio. May it live forever. KPFA, 94.1 FM, Berkeley, California. I'll be back next week. Thank you.
If you've had breast cancer or love someone who has, you're not alone. Breast Cancer's Action Town Meeting for